Pretty good, huh?
Okay. Good morning, everyone. The Senate E-12 Finance Division will come to order. Today is Thursday, February 12, 2015. We have two primary items on the agenda. There'll be reports from the Department of Education, one, the Testing Reduction Advisory Group, and also we'll hear on the Aligning Teacher Development and Evaluation Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System and QComp report. We have a couple of persons that have indicated they wish to testify. If you'd like to testify and you haven't shared that with us, please let us know and we'll do our very best to accommodate. For the viewing audience, these documents that we will refer to should be posted on the department website as well as on our committee website if you'd like to get further information. So we'll start with the Testing Reduction Advisory Group, and leading off will be Assistant Commissioner Kevin McHenry. And welcome back, Mr. McHenry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner, the Department of Education. Thanks for having the opportunity to testify here in front of you today. What I was planning on doing was providing an overview, obviously, of our Assessment Reduction Advisory Group, but I'd like to give just a brief overview of where we're at in our assessment system today, just to provide some foundation. So again, I'm going to take a quick look at our statewide assessments in Minnesota, get the recommendations of the Testing Advisory Work Group, and then also we do have some survey information on local assessments that have been that districts are providing. So starting off first, obviously, for our assessments, we do have federal and state requirements for accountability in math and reading in grades 3 through 8. And once in high school, all of our standards approved by the federal requirements, they all have to be aligned to our specific state standards. So all of our tests do go through alignment studies and review in order to make sure that they are aligned specifically to our state standards. So again, math and reading in 3 through 8, once in high school, our science we give once in elementary, middle, and in high school. And then for our English learners, those are in every grade. And again, those are gonna be assessing English proficiency in specific subjects. Our state requirements on top of our federal requirements, after legislation had passed 2 years ago, we do have a grade eight and a grade 10 exam in math, reading, and writing. And both exams, they do have to be predictive of how a student would perform on a college entrance exam and also provide information on career exploration. When a student takes the tests in 8th and 10th grade, if they do not perform at a specific level, they do have the option of taking a placement diagnostic exam before taking that specific grade 11 college entrance exam. And the college entrance exam, again, has to cover math, reading, and in writing. So basically, this is a picture of what I had just went through. As you can see, the requirements of tests that we need to provide for state and federal accountability are in red. Those are the MCAs and the MTAS. The access, again, that's for English learners in all grades. And then if you look at the blue dots, those are the 8th and 10th grade tests that I had mentioned for college and career predictability. We are administering the Explore and Plan. The Compass has to be administered between after taking the plan and before the ACT. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
The Compass would be offered anytime between after the plan and before the ACT. And again, the ACT would be offered in 11th grade. So when these tests are administered, again, we try to break them up between federal and state accountability and college and career readiness. So late winter, the access for ELLs is offered. In the springtime, grades 3 through 8, obviously in high school reading and math, our MCAs are offered. And then in the fall is when we offer our college and career assessments. For the most part, it's going to be the Explore and Plan are offered in the fall. And then the ACT, we do offer that, but that is offered in the springtime, and it's on one specific date in the school year, which we can get to. So that's a snapshot of just where we're at with our assessments. And again, the commissioner was tasked by Governor Dayton of reviewing all of our assessments that are required by state and federal law that we are administering, and reviewing of what we can do to actually reduce assessments while still meeting the specific high standards for Minnesota students. What we did in order to pull this group together is whenever we're reviewing a specific issue, we like to make sure that we're including professionals in the field and as far as how these recommendations will impact others. So we looked at committees we already had ongoing. We had an assessment advisory committee that's an ongoing committee that represents professionals in the assessment field throughout the state. We have the local assessment and accountability advisory committee that is another committee. Again, it is comprised of testing professionals throughout the state. And then we used those two as our foundation for membership and then broadened it. We included members of the business community, including the Business Partnership and Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And then we looked at other school associations to provide some more information. We had groups such as the school superintendents, the school principals, C, AMSD. We had school psychologists. We had a really broad variety of participation through our group members. And so I'm going to move over to the recommendations that were provided from the group. And again, the group did represent a wide variety of interests across the state, and the recommendations provide the consensus of where the group arrived. There are individual groups that I will, as I go through this presentation, would like to say that they may not agree 100%, but I think everybody felt that this was a good consensus agreement.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Johnson.
Just a quick question. On page 5 of your first report, if a student is not ready for career or college, they're given a college placement diagnostic test. Can you tell me why or what you get from that?
Ms. McKinney?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the purpose of that was to provide some more information if a student isn't on track, where a student could actually take the placement or a placement diagnostic exam to provide some more information as where that student may or may not need some additional instruction. So that was the idea behind the law and why that test is offered.
Thank you.
So again, the main recommendations of what the group recommended was they felt that we should stop the administration of the grade 8, the grade 10 career and college assessment exam. They felt we should stop the college placement diagnostic exam. And they recommended reducing the high school science MCA. The background on this, in the conversation with the committee, centered on the fact that the Explore and Plan offered by ACT was something that was very supported heavily by districts. It's something that was being administered by, before the law passed, by about 80% of districts throughout the state. The districts really appreciated the specific reporting information that came from those two tests. They thought it was very helpful for the individual student and the parent and really thought that those were very helpful tests in preparing for a college entrance exam. Eventually, that test is going to go away and be replaced by a different exam called the Aspire. The reporting available for the Aspire test is not the exact same as the Explore and Plan. And the group felt that that reporting environment wasn't necessarily as advantageous as the Explore and Plan, and recommended that our MCAs actually should include the college and career predictability rather than having our MCAs that are aligned to our state standards and for federal accountability and the additional college entrance exam. Again, this group was looking at test reduction And this goes to the question of what Senator Johnson just raised, that they did recommend eliminating the use of the compass placement diagnostic exam. The rationale behind using the compass, as I said, was the test was supposed to be used to provide specific information on where teachers can provide specific information or interventions. The diagnostic exam for different subjects can be multiple tests. The diagnostic exam in particular can be up to 17 tests in math and reading, and the placement exam can be up to 5 different tests. I think what after the group reviewed that, felt that what was needed was more information, better reporting out of our current tests, rather than using several additional tests to get information to provide better interventions for students. And the group also did recommend eliminating the high school science MCA. Now, again, this recommendation was something that was debated significantly within the committee. There are some in the group that felt that we should keep the science MCA, and there were others that felt that we shouldn't. Most felt we should get rid of the high school science MCA, and that the science standards could be covered in a different test in high school. And again, that was a consensus of the group. And again, there's some nuances within that recommendation. So with those recommendations, what that looks like is the group did say, did recommend to continue administering the MCAs in grade 3-8. The benefits of administering the MCAs in 3-8 was, number one, they are aligned to our state standards. You're testing each year in grades 3-8. You can measure growth. And it's a fair measurement across the state for all schools. They did also recommend to continue administering the grade 10 reading MCA and the grade 11 math MCA. Again, those are specific tests aligned that are built specifically to our state standards. They meet the specific benchmarks that are required in statute. But some of the caveats with that, with those recommendations, is the group did feel that we should reevaluate options if there are some federal, flexibility within ESEA, whether that means grade band testing, if it's maybe testing every other year. I think the option was without federal approval, we wouldn't be able to eliminate tests that were aligned to our specific state standards. The group also, as I stated before, was very interested in enhanced reporting. In the reporting that they saw from the Explore and Plan test, they were very interested in making sure that the tests that we're specifically building to our state standards provided very beneficial information to the student, down to specific strand data in specific subjects. And they did agree with the piece that is in current law that all of our tests should be predictive of performance on a college entrance exam. As we're building our tests right now, that's something that's being built into each test. So there are benchmarks starting in third grade all the way moving forward of if a student's on track to meet those specific requirements. The group also did recommend to continue to administer a college entrance exam, specifically including the writing component. But they did feel that it should be offered in either 11th or 12th grade, and that could be a district decision. One of the issues right now, we are administering the ACT, and that's something that we've received very good feedback from districts across the state. That's something that is recognized across the nation. It's recognized by all of our colleges and universities. Again, it's a product that's specifically made for a specific reason for college entrance. It's not specifically built to our specific Minnesota state standards. And as they're meeting specific requirements that are needed for colleges and universities across the country, what they need to meet for those requirements, they may not be the same of what is required of Minnesota schools. So, as we build our tests, we have very specific accessibility requirements to make sure that our tests are available to all students. They still do have accessibility requirements, but it's not the exact same as our state standards. There's more flexibility when we build our own tests. And the requirements around ACT, what we have right now is we have one specific date for administration, which is April 28th, and we have one makeup date. And there are specific requirements through ACT of why there are specific dates to offer that test. And in comparison, our testing window for MCAs is it's March. We got about a three-month window for our administration of our MCAs, starting on March 8th. The other recommendation was to continue to administer a career interest survey, along with some presentations you'll hear from others, and you've already heard of the how necessary it is to make sure that students are thinking about what they will do beyond high school in their career in college, and making sure that they are thinking about their interest earlier on in their educational career. The group felt that it was important to still administer a career interest survey in 8th and 10th grade. They wanted to make sure that that survey was available to every student in the state of Minnesota, and that survey would be transferable across districts. So if you have highly mobile students, when they move from one district to another, that the training for professionals in the school will be the same throughout the state for the same specific career interest survey. And they also felt that it was important to make sure on that interest survey that we did receive input, not just from the school professionals, but we also included higher ed, MinSCU, and DEED. As we move forward, that is something that we will be looking at as far as how we can make sure we still have a career interest survey that's valuable to students. I mentioned the accessibility requirements for the state. The underlying theme for the group was to make sure that all students were allowed to participate in testing and that they were treated fairly so they could actually show how they performed and knew our state standards. They wanted to make sure that there were specific accommodations for all students, that there were alternative tests, and specific exemptions where necessary. A couple of the other recommendations where the group brought forward, I discussed the reporting enhancements already. I think that's something that we currently already are building with our MCAs, but that's something that we also took from the group as getting input from higher education, from K-12 groups, to make sure that the reports are helpful to families, to teachers, to students, and how they can also be transferable to when a student moves to higher education. They also wanted us to take a look at reviewing the MCAs and see and review the options to see how that can be used to inform college admissions. Can the MCAs, if they're aligned to our state standards, be used as a substitute for other college entrance exams, and how those tests can actually be useful in course placement in college. Again, this gets back to the reporting of having very detailed reporting within our tests that can inform where a student needs additional instruction. In the letter that when these recommendations were submitted to the chairs of the committee, the cover letter, the commissioner did indicate that she appreciates the recommendations that were brought forward by the group, thought they were very thoughtful. In general, supports trying to find ways to reduce testing. She's reviewing it as far in terms of what other areas can we continue to further reduce tests. But one of the recommendations she thought would be helpful to put out for thought was capping the percentage time for tests for instruction. Right now, specific information here. What she recommended in the letter was to have a 2% of all instructional time, no more than 2% of instructional time can be dedicated to assessments. What that turns into be is in grades 1 through 6, students are required by Minnesota to have 935 hours of instructional time. A 2% cap would account for students taking having no more than 18.7 hours of testing in elementary. And then in grades 7 through 12, students have to have 1,020 hours, which a 2% cap would require about 20.4 hours for secondary assessments. And so what we look at the chart here is these are the percentage times by grade of how much instructional time our current tests account for. And
excuse me, Mr. McHenry, is this the actual administration of the tests that we're talking for this 2% cap?
The Mr. Chair, members, the yes, it would include the 2% includes the administration time for the test.
Would it include test preparation or so-called teaching for the test?
Mr. Chair, members, no, this would be specifically just to administer the tests. I think what the commissioner would also say to as a response to that is that we should be teaching to our standards and instructing our students rather than spending instructional time teaching to a specific test. But if you look at this chart again, this is to dig into a little bit more, you'll notice that the time spent administering our state and federally required tests, they do vary throughout grades, but for the most part, they do represent a small portion of instructional time for students. And for the most part, they are under about 1% of our total instructional time. And I think what her thoughts or what her recommendation for the 2% would include our state tests, and it also include our local tests as well. So for this, to help inform the work of the task force, we did a survey of districts just to get a better understanding of the type of assessments that are being offered on a local level. And again, I think what I want to make sure is that we're conveying is that the group did see there are different reasons to administer different tests. Again, our for federal accountability and state accountability, we do have tests aligned to standards. But they did see value of providing, there are reasons to provide other types of tests. So we did ask districts voluntarily to complete a survey between November 5th and November 20th. And the idea was just so we could get a better picture to help inform this task force of assessments that are offered throughout the state. We had 254 districts or schools that did respond. And again, there's a variety of different assessments that can be offered. We did outline some specific tests that are outlined here for districts to provide a quick reaction to. But we also did provide an opportunity for districts to add other assessments that they were administering. The rationale behind the test you see up here, the AIMS-Web, ASFAB, NWEA, where these were tests that were being offered in a higher level throughout districts. At one point before moving on to the next slide, I did want to point out that the OLPA math and the OLPA reading.
Mr. McHenry, I know there's a viewing audience as well, and perhaps some of us aren't even sure what some of these acronyms are. So
sure,
including me.
I'm going to ask our assessment director, Jennifer Dugan, to come up, and she can give a little background on each specific test that is offered on the local level.
Thank you, Ms. Dugan.
Thanks for having me. Jennifer Dugan, Director for Statewide Testing at the Minnesota Department of Education. So these assessments that are listed here are used for a variety of reasons in districts. So, for example, Kevin was just talking about the OLPA math and OLPA reading, and those are assessments that Minnesota, the Department of Education, makes available to districts. They're optional. They are free to use.
Ms. Dugan, OLPA?
Optional local purpose assessment.
Of course.
Checking to see if you knew.
So that was the best our division could do. Clearly, we're not very creative people. So the OLPA test is available to districts, and they use it for a variety of purposes. And you'll see in the following slide the frequency of use. Some districts are using it with a specific group of students. Some districts are giving it to all of their students. The OLPA math assessment is available in grades 3 through 8, and each student has the opportunity to test twice in those grades. OLPA reading is available in grades 3 through 8 and 10, so you'll notice that that corresponds with the MCA. OLPA reading, they only have one testing opportunity this year. So that was a lot about OLPA. The OLPA results, again, are on the MCA metric. So, again, districts are using that for a variety of purposes. That testing window opens in the fall, and this year
McHenry,
it closes.
I think you're blocking part of the someone. Mr. Gunn. Okay,
there.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So the OPA window opens in the fall and closes on February 20th. So it closes at the middle-ish of February each year. NWEA or MAP testing is a widely used assessment that is an online assessment. It is adaptive. Many districts are using this to look at longitudinal data and looking at growth over time, and so many districts use it and administer NWA multiple times for an individual student during a given year, again, to look at that growth, maybe in the fall, maybe in the winter, again in the spring. They use it in a variety of ways. Let's see, ASFAB is the I'm not going to get the entire acronym right now, but is the military entrance or interest inventory. So that's a high school
aptitude
assessment.
Battery, I believe.
And then the other ones are primarily used looking at reading or I can't speak to exactly how every district is using them, but many districts are using these to target instruction. And I'm sure they're using NWA and OPA for that as well, but targeting instruction, placement in specific programs, for example. So different districts are using them in different ways. And again, we were really, the purpose of the survey was, I think what you're asking is honestly the second part. The survey, when we released the survey, we were just looking at what assessments are they giving across the board in a given grade. And so we were just trying to get that snapshot of how many assessments were being offered across the state in multiple grade bands. We did not ask any questions about how they use that data, or what the objective, what they were looking for out of the results. And so I think that would be a purpose of a follow-up survey if we were to ask them to do that. Because, again, that was not included in the survey. So it would be hard for me to talk specifically about how districts are using this because that wasn't necessarily part of the survey.
That's noted. It's local control, their option. And Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know how many of these tests that the students actually get some feedback on?
Ms. Dugan?
So, thank you. I'll talk just mostly about OLPA because that's the one that I would be the most familiar with. And the answer is local control, and it varies. So, for example, a student might take OLPA, and the teacher may look at the information to help instruction. But those results may or may not be provided to the parent or to the student. And so, they're using it in a variety of ways. And again, I think we would need to do some follow-up analysis and survey of the districts to answer that.
Senator Stone.
Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Dugan, it seems like maybe that's one of the frustration I think that parents have as well as students, is the you know, the testing and the they have no connection to the outcome of what they have been tested on. And I think parents, from the perspective that, you know, their son or daughter may be lacking in, let's say, math or something, but they really don't know what areas that or how to approach to satisfy that deficit. And it seems that it would be much better if you're going to test that you at least have some connection to, well, I didn't do well in fractions, or I didn't do so good in something else. And then the parents have an opportunity to kind of work with their child, unless they're already over, way beyond the parents' capabilities. But I think that's some of the frustration that I hear from back in my communities, is that you just have the testing, and it seems like it's fairly constant, but no follow through.
Ms. Dugan?
Thank you. I'll do my best to address how we are looking at that. And Assistant Commissioner McHenry talked about the reporting enhancements that we're looking at, and one of those pieces is a parent portal. And so we're really looking at how can we get the information to parents in a more informative way, in a more time-sensitive manner, and looking at just reporting enhancements overall and where we can improve that communication and that support, because it is important information to be providing. One point of clarification that I do want to make, MCA results are federally required to be shared with parents. And so my answer about OPAL results being local decision of what they share and how they use or share that information, because the OPA is not a federally mandated assessment, they're not required to do that. But on the MCA, we're federally required to ask each district to verify that that information was provided and shared with all parents. And so the MCAs, the reports do go home to parents. I will say that this year, those paper reports are maybe not in as time sensitive as they could be, and we're definitely looking for ways to improve that and in the future.
Mr. Chair, do that.
We have Senator Bonoff, Senator Pratt, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner McHenry, I understand you spoke about the fact that the Explore and the Plan tests are no longer supported, and so it's your recommendation, I believe, that we move away from that. Was there no heads up, no inkling that was going to come down? Because we actually passed a law, you know, last session that we were going to now switch to the Explore plan and the ACT. And so and that rationale actually in moving to the ACT was that it was connected to these earlier tests so that we could diagnostically help students figure out where they're going to be off by the time they get to the ACT and then do some kind of intervention. And so if we lose these two and move to a different test, then does it still connect with the ACT? And are we still recommending that that be there? And do we actually then need to address it in with language with regard to that? Because we did pass it as a law. So go ahead.
Mr. Henry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, and that's a great question. Appreciate that. I'll provide some background information and, again, let Ms. Dugan provide a little bit more. But when the law passed two sessions ago, it didn't specifically name the individual tests. It did outline a college and career readiness exam. So at the time, what we understood was that these were the tests, the Explore and Plan, that were being administered by the ACT. We didn't have final specific information, I don't think, provided to us or to the legislature of what specific product ACT would offer in the future. But I think as we've begun our contract to administer these tests, we have found out more specific information of the direction that ACT is going. And I think the feedback that we have received from districts is that the information that was provided on the Explore and Plan, as far as reporting into the specific data, was something that they may not see in the upcoming product that's going to be offered by ACT. Yeah. So what the group did recommend was that college and career predictability that was in the Explore and Plan, that should be built into the tests that we're actually constructing.
Follow-up?
Senator Baumhouse.
Thank you. So that's kind of complicated, so we look forward to your recommended changes. And that is too bad that, you know, that happened, but nothing you can do about it. But then the other thing I noticed in your report is in the career survey that you're giving to the students that you cite getting input from OAG, MinSCU, and Deed, and I'm wondering why you didn't include the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I believe that recommendation was just making sure that we included a variety of outside resources that represented higher ed. We're not required to specifically work with one institution or another, and that's something we can do, is work with the University of Minnesota as well. I can say that the commissioner already has shared these recommendations with both the chancellor of MinSCU and the president of the University of Minnesota in order to move forward.
Thanks.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you touched on the issue of a follow-up survey, because when I look at the data on testing, my first question is why. We hear from districts that students are over-tested, that it's taking away from learning time, and yet local districts are finding value in these tests. Now, I was involved when our district moved to the NWA MAP test, and the reason was we weren't getting feedback on the MCAs. In fact, we got my daughter's MCA results in October. And so to Senator Stump's issue, there was nothing we could do about it. We couldn't work with the teacher to devise a plan if there was a deficiency. It wasn't timely enough for her to choose her classes for the next year. We're the NWEA measuring growth and also proficiency in giving results in a more timely manner that teachers are using. In fact, one of the concerns I hear from teachers is that they don't even get the MCA results until mid to end of September. So I guess I have two questions. One, what is the delay in getting those MCA results? And two, now that you're going to a computer-based testing platform, when will teachers have and parents have those results so that they can be actionable?
Thank you. So last year, all districts had access to results within an hour of the student completing their assessment. Because, again, as you stated, if the student took the online assessment last year, all grades, the district had access to those results within an hour. That is the same. Last year, without grade 11 was the one exception, because we needed to set standards on that. That was the first year of that test. This year, all online tests, math, reading, science, all grades 3 through 8 and high school, all of those assessments for MCA online will have immediate results available to districts and teachers within an hour. There is information in that report that does provide strand level information for an individual student that could be shared either with the student or with the parent, and again used for course registration, what have you. We do need to, after the assessments are, those are not the official reports that are provided to parents, because when we had our last reporting revision in 2006, parents said they really wanted to know how their student performed in comparison to the rest of the state. And so we have to wait for the testing window to complete before we can say how that student performed with respect to the school, the district, and the state. And so we have to aggregate that. And then we also provide a percentile rank of the student's performance. And so, again, We currently are waiting for the testing window to close and then calculating that percentile rank, which is included on the individual student report that is provided. The reports this year will be available rather than October. I think they were received October 1st, I think, this year. But in 15, the reports will be available in the districts in the summer. That, again, is not as informative as it could be, and that's, again, why we're looking at ways to provide the feedback in a parent portal and looking for enhancements, not just in the timelines, but also in the information that we provide to parents to help instruction.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, followed by Senator Kent and Senator Torres-Ray.
I have two, I think, quite simple questions. First of all, are the optional tests, are they in the child's record? Are they put in the record so that it can be used by the parents if they choose or anyone else? And the second one is on your page 14 of your presentation. All students are allowed to participate in testing. Does that mean they can opt out?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, again, the recommendation on this in particular of saying that students are allowed to participate in testing, that was more specific towards making sure that students that had different requirements or specific disabilities were still able to participate in all tests. And so that was where that specific recommendation was for. Students and parents do have the option of opting their student out of testing. That wasn't something that was specifically discussed in this testing reduction committee.
So clarification on
Senator
that.
Johnson.
So you're saying the parents could opt out, not the student themselves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, yeah, the parent does have the option of opting his or her son or daughter out of testing.
And then regarding the optional tests.
Student,
thank you. So the optional test, the reports are available to the district, school, and teacher. How they provide that information is to the student or the parent is their local decision. Again, it's not part of accountability in any way, and so we don't use those results. So if a student moved from District A to District B, we would not have that record for them to look up, just as we don't have their NWEA record or their Ames Web record. So we don't house those records, and they would, but they may, depending on the district, a given district's policy, they may transfer in a student's cumulative folder, for example.
Sarah Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senator Bonoff covered a lot of what I was going to ask about the change with regard to the ACT, so I just want to have one additional clarifying kind of comment question. I know we did not specify ACT in statute, but very clearly Commissioner Casilius, Commissioner Pogemiller, and Chancellor Rosenstone were here, and they talked about the ACT suite as a whole and how valuable that would be. And so I also find it confusing that, you know, 2 years later, and in the world of trying to minimize tests, we're saying we want to get rid of that one and we want to replace it with something very similar. And I just want to say as a comment, I'm concerned that when we try to make our own tests, we do that and we have some fits and starts to get them to where we think they're actually working, and how many years is it going to take till we get the kinks out of our own version until we have something effective? So having watched this journey over the past couple of years, I do find this very concerning. So that's really just a comment at this point. With regard to, and I have an eighth grader, so I live this notion of the role that MCAs play and then the role of the other tests that we all experience as parents, and the way they get handled and treated by teachers and in the schools. You know, one of the things I've always noticed is when it's MCA time, which really seems to be much more about the accountability part for the schools and the professionals. It's, you know, all hands on deck. Everybody make sure your kid gets plenty of sleep. Everybody make sure there's good breakfast and all that stuff, and the whole school comes to a stop during a window while we're doing that. But when you look at the, for example, the MAP tests, which are much more understood to be about the individual student and how they're doing and how they're tracking, because they are adaptive and we do get the information immediately, that's a different mechanism. So I think it's a much more nuanced look at how tests are being administered, how they're being used, and because right now none of them serves all the purposes needed, it's beyond frustrating, I'll just say that. And you know, I don't know if we're ever going to be able to get the MCAs to be, you know, Ms. Dugan, you said the thing about that parents say they want to see the information in the context of how the rest of the state does. Well, can that not be a follow-up? I mean, if it takes months to get that particular piece of data together, can't we at least get the individual students' information available so that everybody can see it and we can be aware of what's going on? And I would just say one more thing, is again, from the parents' perspective, you know, one of the things that I've found valuable about the MAP test and getting to see those numbers over time in that longitudinal way is one of the key pieces of information I've gotten about my son is that he's a pretty erratic test taker. And that in and of itself is a useful bit of information. But the way the MCA is done and measured and reported, you don't get to see that level of information. So I appreciate where we're going, but I still feel like we're a long way from where we need to be. I don't know if you have any comments on that mess, but thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, appreciate the feedback on that. The one thing I on a couple points just wanted to make in response, whenever we go out for a bid or for an RFP, as a state, we have to be as open as possible and make sure that we are not constructing any RFP for any specific vendor, unless that is something that's required in statute. The way the legislation was drafted is that we did have to include a nationally recognized college entrance exam, and the way we constructed our RFP was based off of the legislation. We did, in order to get as many responses to our RFP, we did separate and have two RFPs, knowing that there are there's only two nationally recognized college entrance exams that are offered. One is the ACT and one is the SAT, and that's why we did separate that. We didn't name a specific vendor in that RFP, but again, ACT was the lone responder and the one that did get the contract. I think the issues that you're raising are very valid. One of the issues, there's pros and cons to using a state test, or there's pros and cons to using a product that's off the shelf. We do have more control in tests that we build, where a vendor may build something specific to needs that are met across different states across the nation, and not built specifically to Minnesota requirements. And what is shared what's shared publicly by vendors, as they're moving products forward, we may not have all the information of what they're doing at the time. So I realize that is frustrating. I think we were frustrated as well, hearing all the feedback that we're getting from districts on the Explorin plan, and we're interested in the information that we have received now of what we can do to move forward that's in the best interest of students and parents. As far as the reporting that's offered by, you know, other vendors, you mentioned NWEA, we don't argue that they do provide some great feedback for students and for parents. We've met with NWA, we've heard from parents and districts of the value of that specific test. But one of the things that we have to do with our state tests is make sure that we're using those for accountability purposes. And I think anytime you're bringing accountability into the equation, it doesn't matter what the test is, there is going to be a level of anxiety that does go up. And we want to do our best to make sure that the tests are as valuable as possible, but knowing that it is for accountability purposes, there is going to be some of that anxiety as well. But I appreciate your comments. They're very helpful.
Members will take a few more questions or comments, and then we're going to go to the next report. We
will have specific proposals that we'll be considering, and this is a good introduction on it. And I would expect in the first week or so of March, we'll have a specific hearing looking at proposals, including one that I'll have on information related to this. So, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comment right now, because I do think that it is very important we figure out where do we go from here. I don't know if the department is aware of the fact that millennials and young people are very savvy with respect to what do they have to do now and what they don't have to do. What I understand is that juniors and seniors understand that they can take college credits early and save money. I understand that they know what tests they should take and they don't, and they what tests they should not take. In some of the schools in my district, there are seniors who clearly understand that the ACT is the exam that matters. And there has been a tremendous movement to tell each other to bring to their parents a form to sign onto so that they don't have to take any other tests, because these tests in their heads do not matter. What I find fascinating about that movement is that the kids that are pursuing that movement are kids that are very bright, and they already have very good ACT scores. They took their ACT exam early, so they know what colleges are they're going to go to. They know they can get in the GPA that they need, and so they are savvy enough to say, well, I'm going to take the credits that I need. I'm already accepted to the University of Minnesota. These tests are nothing for me. I already know the GPA. They are applying early. So I am curious about what is that we are left with, because this is kind of the essence of this policy, right? We are trying to pursue an effort to help those kids that are not ready for college. Ironically, we are testing them late, finding what we already know, what is, you know, because I compare the groups that I hear about. Those kids that are not going to make it, that we know already don't have the GPA that they need, they're not taking the ACT early because they're afraid that they're not going to pass. So this is the group, this is the cohort that I'm most concerned about. I'm not concerned about the ones that I already know. They have a good GPA, and they can nail the ACT, and they have a plan, and they are taking early college credits. So I find it very ironic that I hear, you know, this movement of these young people going in this direction, and I wonder, what is the department? I don't know if you know about it, and I don't know if there is a way to for us to really figure out at the end, what are we doing here? Are we really helping those who need to be helped by providing the information early? Are these testings helping? So I don't know if you have some information related to that.
Brief response,
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, thank you for the point. I think overall, you're correct, is that the value of the ACT is seen by all students and how that impacts their lives moving beyond high school. As the legislation moved forward and as we've supported having that college entrance exam, the idea was there was equitable access for all students across the state. So if there was a financial means, transportation means, that would be something that would be covered because they'd be taking it in their own school. And also knowing that they would have to take that college entrance exam, students would have to start preparing for that earlier on in their educational career. And so what we are doing in response with that legislation is making sure that the tests that we're in charge of or that we're building to help students prepare to not only meet the Minnesota state standards, but also to predict how they will perform on a specific college entrance exam. As far as if a parent is opting their students out of taking the test, again, we do respect local control. We respect parents' wishes for their own student. And those are some individual decisions that do have to be made. But we think it's in our best interest to make sure that tests that we have to administer for state and federal accountability are built as best we can to meet our state standards and to predict performance on a college entrance exam. And as you mentioned, also make sure we give timely and good reporting to not only the teachers, but also the parents. So that's something that we're working towards.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund and then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Chair Wicker. Just wanted to ask, and I think you've already kind of answered this, but just wanted to ask specifically, was there any consideration of replacing the MCA with the NWA MAP test? I mean, I think it has some things that the adaptability and the growth measurement, it already has some of those things. Was there any discussion about that? Because I feel like reading the recommendations, there's really not much of an option for elementary ages for schools to streamline their testing now other than taking away tests that they use locally because they believe that it gives them, you know, beneficial information.
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wicklund. And that's a great point. Again, the recommendations here aren't saying, you know, stop doing specific tests. The group didn't necessarily recommend replacing the MCAs with any other specific tests. I will say that there were some nuances within the conversation between different groups. Some were very adamant that we have to make sure that our state tests are aligned to our state standards and that we had control of making sure that we were meeting our state standards. And there were others, I think that maybe not necessarily on the elementary level, but felt that we could use more tests or more local option tests in the high school level to meet accountability mechanisms. And there were some push and pull on that side. But again, ultimately, that wasn't the recommendation of the group. I will say that we, you know, again, getting back to the RFP we put out, in order for tests to be used for accountability, they do need to be aligned to our state standards. What happens is when our RFP goes out, we have our responders. When we do have our final vendor selected, the tests do need to go through an alignment process to make sure that they are reviewed and are aligned to our standards. And so we do know that the tests that we make now are aligned to our standards. The question whether NWEA would be used in place of that, I mean, that's not something that we would know for sure until they would go through a specific alignment study. That being said, I know we've met with NWEA, and they will have some rationale of why they believe that it would be aligned to our state standards, and we don't necessarily agree or disagree. It's just not something that has specifically gone through that alignment study.
Senator Wicklund.
So what would it take for us to pursue that question, I guess, is that, you know, is that something that we would have to say direct the department to perform that sort of asking and finding out that information, or is that something that you have the control of?
Mr. McHenry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wicklund, you know, the alignment process is something that does take significant time. So I think we need to, if we were going to review any test for alignment, that we would need the ability and the staff time to actually be able to do that. I can let Ms. Dugan talk about for federal accountability what that might go into, but you know, in order for that to be the specific test, there's a couple different options, I guess, if that's what you were looking at. There would have to be a specific recommendation for a test to be used for, whatever it might be, to be used for accountability purposes. But I think one of the decisions that you all would have to go through is what specifically does that mean to align to accountability standards? If a test is built and not aligned to our specific state standards, are you satisfied by using another test that doesn't specifically align to our state standards as well? So that might be something to wrestle with.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, a comment. When I look at all these testing things, one of the things that I think is really important is there's diagnostic tests and what I call proving tests. Proving tests are benchmark tests, an ACT test. They have a very unique purpose to them, and they are kind of a pass-fail, yes, no, or qualify you for college entrance, things like that. Diagnostic tests are very different. It's a teaching tool to know what they know, what they don't know, so that you can fill in the gaps. Very, very different. And so I lean heavily, especially in these early middle school times where you need that. And there are very specific local needs. If you have a very low reading score in your school, that they're not proficient for third grade at a very low level, boy, I'd be thinking that kindergarten, first, second grade ought to be doing a lot of work that way. So my concern is when you have some of these statewide kinds of things going on, that you interfere with the ability and take up the time that could be better used by teachers in making use of these. The other thing is all these tests should be open to parents and students. Wasn't the most frequent thing you'd hear was you're not working up to your potential, but nobody told you what your potential was to work up to. How can you do that? How can parents be supportive and helpful if you don't give them the very basic information that they need? And so those are kind of three things that are really important. On this testing, though, again, part of that there's some requirements to get a diploma. So on some of these opt-outs, are there certain tests that you must take in order to get a diploma, though? Because you don't want to mess up inadvertently that we've set a requirement, take something away or give them an opt-out, and then they have issues with getting a diploma. So just more of a quick question. Are there tests required in order to get a diploma, and what are they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, there are course requirements that are required in order for students to meet, and credit requirements. There are testing requirements that students are required to meet as well. And that's what you'll see in the MCA tests that are aligned specifically to our state standards. But again, those are for state and federal accountability. And the opt-out clause is something that is allowed under federal accountability as well as state accountability, that if there's a reason that a parent would opt their student out of a test for any special circumstance, that they still would be able to graduate and they would not be denied a diploma.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, and Mr. McHenry, Ms. Dugan, thank you for the presentation. As I said, this is a start for the session on the topic. We appreciate the report, and there's a number of follow-up items that have been acknowledged. I'd also like to get the cost of tests, and to the extent that you have that from our state budget, and which we'll be getting an overview next week. But something more on that, and if you have any estimates as to what districts may be spending on that, no discussion right now, but in the future, and we will devote a meeting or more on student testing as well as testing as it relates to licensure and a number of issues. The importance of linking this all with higher ed is so important as we look at our ultimate goal of college career post-secondary readiness. And so we'll keep all those objectives in mind as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes, Senator Torres-Ray, and then I'll ask the next group of presenters to approach as Senator Torres-Ray poses her comment.
Thank you very much. I just want to follow up on your request for the cost. I think that having a chart that is just as clear as, you know, how many tests are there and the cost associated with that would be very helpful. So thank you for requesting that. I'll be very interested in seeing the cost and the cost attached to the exam and then the overall.
Thank you. I believe Mr. McHenry has noted that then. Excellent. We'll go next to the report on aligning teacher development, evaluation, alternative teacher professional pay system, and QCOMP. We have members from co-chairing the group, the department. We'll start with Rose Hermanson. And as in the earlier testimony, please identify yourself, each of the presenters, as you present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Rose Hermanson, Assistant to the Commissioner at the Department of Ed. How we're going to
Ms. Hermanson, we're going to get the mic a little closer.
How we're going to present today is I'm going to do a kind of a background of both programs. and you charged us as a legislature to look at how we align them. I have with me Kelly Spees, who's the QCOMP coordinator in Wilmington Public Schools, and I have Misty Sato from the University of Minnesota. They were the co-chairs of the committee that put this report together. So I'm going to provide the background, and then they are going to explain and talk about the recommendations that came from the working group. Here was the charge that the legislature gave to the group. We were supposed to find a way to better align the alternative professional pay system, commonly known as QCOMP, and the teacher development evaluation program, and to find an effect and fund an improved alignment of these two systems. I think as we go through this, you'll see that there's a lot of overlap between what the two systems do. And we have half the districts in the state in one program and all the districts in the state that are required to do the teacher evaluation. I'm going to give you some acronyms here. Education loves acronyms. So ATPPS is the Alternative Pay System, commonly called QCOMP, and TDE will be the teacher evaluation. Just a little background. In 2002, well over a decade ago now, the state passed what was at that time a pilot program on an alternative teacher compensation system. This was done under the Ventura administration. It was an application process, and we allocated $3.6 million to five districts. The focus at that time was coming up with alternative pay or salary schedules, and also how to develop career ladders for teachers so that teachers had a way to advance without necessarily taking them out of the classroom. The idea is we want to maintain some of our best and brightest teachers in the classroom. The results are this program became a precursor then to what eventually became the QCOMP system. Those five districts that were funded at that time could either do the entire district or they could do school sites within the district. And I still remember the districts. La Crescent was one. Floodwood was another. They did the whole district. Rushford-Peterson did two out of their three buildings. Marshall did the entire district, and Minneapolis was doing site by site. So those were the five districts that began this process back in the year 2000. When QCOMP came into play, additional dollars were allocated. By the way, at that time, it was $150 per student for the schools or sites and districts participating. In 2005, when QCOMP began, it began under the Palenty administration, was a bipartisan effort. And what was added besides the other elements was an increased focus on student and teacher growth. And substantially more funding was added to the program, $75 million. There are four basic components in this QCOMP system. You have to have career ladders or options for teacher leadership, ongoing site-based professional development, and this is usually job embedded. There was a teacher evaluation process and also a teacher compensation component within that system. Most frequently, what they were still asking districts to do is find a different kind of structure, payment structure, and so much of the review process was looked at how they may have restructured teacher pay underneath that their proposal. The districts had to do a letter of intent to let us know they were serious about proceeding. That had to be signed off. There was a provision in the statute said that this had to be submitted by joint agreement. So both the teacher union leadership and the district had to sign off on it. It was not embedded necessarily in the contract, but it, partly so you had more options to reopen and make some changes, but it was the term used was joint agreement. There was an application process. They had to set site goals. There was annual reports, program updates. Department provided technical assistance, and there was compliance monitoring. In 2014-15, we had 81 out of 337 districts participating. Now, that's only 24% of the districts. There are 69 of our charter schools participating, but when you look at the number of students that were part of those districts, we are covering approximately half the state. So primarily larger districts, but not all. And so 415,000 kids are in those districts that are participating in QCOMP. If all approved plans were funded, we do have We have reached the cap. There is a cap on the expenditure. It has been reached. We have two or three districts that are only being partially funded, and we have three or four districts with approved applications, but we have no dollars. And we have had interest from additional districts who want to participate. And much of this increased attention came when we passed the requirement for teacher evaluation, because they saw this as a way of implementing a program with resources. The funding cap I mentioned, $75+ million. We do special school districts, regular school districts, intermediate charters, multi-integration districts, Burbage Center, and school sites. There are some education entities that have teachers that do not qualify. Special ed co-ops, I think, are one. There might be a couple of others. So this program is not necessarily available to all instructional or districts that employ teachers. Those districts are still required to do teacher eval. Charter schools, there's one correction here. Charter school, by the way, this money is both aid and levy. There's $169 of the $260 that's available is state aid, and the rest, the $91, is an equalized levy. Districts are not required to do the levy, although most do. There are a few that do not. Because charter schools have no area to levy on, what we do is we provide them state aid in the average amount of levy that goes out to the other districts. So charter schools' revenue is all state aid. That number, actually, they get $254 per student. There's a correction on the PowerPoint. We updated that. The other, they get $254 of the $260 because that's the state average levy out there, combined the two. Minnesota Department of Ed has staffed the program. Remember, I said it was an application process. Our staff has had to get the letters of intent, review them, work with the districts in approving their application. The department has been using Title $2. We have some discretionary dollars in the Title II to make this program work and staff. I have with me today Christy Anderson, who's been with the KCOP program almost since its inception. Other staff in the department here, Tyler Livingston, has been with our teacher development and evaluation program, and their director, Greg Keith, is here as well. In your package, you have a printout by district, and if you've got bifocals or a magnifying glass, you might be able to read it. But I have staff from Tom Melcher's shop here who every district in the state and charter is listed and indicates whether they are in or out of QCOP at this point. It also, I think, includes how much the other districts would get should they be in QCOP as well. Now, background on the teacher evaluation. This was passed during the 2011 session.
Excuse me, Ms. Hermanson, yes. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of points, and this is kind of a good synopsis, Ms. Hermanson. But one thing that's missing, I think, is the problems with what would be called QCOMP, or actually had a little bit of problem remembering that it was Ventura versus Pawlenty, but Governor Pawlenty was really the one that put it in somewhat the current shape. But why doesn't the synopsis kind of deal with some of the problems, such as it being a very subjective process in the beginning? And another one that I think has driven a lot of people kind of crazy in the districts is the idea that you have a education funding program that doesn't address the general population of students across the state. And, this has been kind of a constant spur under my saddle. And, I'm pleased that we are coming to the point where we're making this a general education issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, I'm going to get a little bit later in my presentation to the similarities and the dissimilarities between the program, and we'll point out that we have found by the number of districts, primarily it has been a metro embrace program. Many rural districts, from our information, have found it more difficult to implement or have chosen not to implement. The application process goes back and forth, and you'll see in one of the recommendations, we would suggest you get the department out of the business of maybe approving or making judgments about a plan as long as we assure compliance with the directions in the statute. So you will, as I go through my presentation, I just wanted to give the basis for both of these programs, and then I'll talk a little bit about the similarities and things that are different. And the working group did spend a lot of time talking, and we've had districts in and out of QCOMP because of some of the issues of trying to implement and how it's being used. And some have implemented it very successfully. And are, we've talked to teachers in general, fundamentally what they really like about the program is the amount of professional development and ways they can enhance their teaching profession and the feedback they're getting from their peers. So the benefits and the negatives I think you're going to find in both programs, and that's why I think you'll see that the recommendations are aligned to maybe making it one that all districts have access to.
Great. I appreciate that, and I think that kind of lives up to the Constitution that we have in our state.
Thank you. Again, how we've staffed it at the department has been through Title $2. There, none of our staff, and when we started the teacher evaluation process, we actually started under principal evaluation. The department, there was no funding at the department. We were directed to do a sample or an example model for districts to use for both principals and teachers. We went to the Bush Foundation, received funding from them in order to employ staff to start developing those models to be implemented. The legislature did give us a one-time appropriation to finish up the teacher evaluation model as well as to go out and pilot it, but I make that point now because we'll get later on the teacher evaluation process. Okay, the teacher, the QCOMP has their own specified statutory designations. When they brought in teacher evaluation, they embedded the teacher evaluation in the teacher continuing contract law and tenure law. There's two laws. 122A.40 is for most of the state. 122A.41 is for cities of first class, which is primarily Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I think Rochester now. Fundamentally, they have a different law. It's been on the books longer, but they do the same thing. The development and evaluation model for teachers was to begin this school year. You passed it in 2011. You provided us with a year to develop the sample model, or some call it a default model. If a district can't reach, again, the term joint agreement is used with their local teachers, districts have the options of developing a local model, but the state has to have a mandated model should they not do that. We went after the session. We immediately started developing. We pulled together a work group as designated in statute and developed a sample model. And the last year, we piloted the model in several districts or components of the model and got feedback. I mentioned the joint agreement. We had the evaluation, our stakeholders group, and we piloted that model last year. The purposes of the program are very similar: to develop, improve, and support qualified teachers and affect teaching practices to improve student outcomes. And I want to stress that. I think the department and both in both programs, the real focus has been how can we work to provide feedback to teachers and improve their teaching in order to have success with students. There were very specific requirements. Again, the teacher evaluation is required of all districts. QCOMP is not. It's a voluntary program. But in the teacher evaluation, 35% of the evaluations must be tied to student academic growth and literacy. And I found the previous discussion interesting because here we required valid and reliable assessments aligned to standards. We have to evaluate all teachers. Part of the issues of implementing this is we don't necessarily test with the MCAs and other tests in all grade levels or in all subjects. but the teacher evaluation model has to be designed to cover every teacher, including special ed, your current technical teachers, your art teacher, your FIA teacher. And so putting together a state model that covers all sizes of districts, whether you're 20 teachers or 4,000 teachers, as well as all of the areas that teachers provide instruction in, was not necessarily an easy task. It also must, and also to have a valid and reliable assessments to predict or to use for the 35% evaluation process is challenging. They developed, and I can get into details if you wish, but I'm going to leave it at that right now. We also had to use longitudinal data on student engagement and other student outcomes. In other words, what's the interaction between the teacher and the students? And that also created a problem. Most frequently, this is being done through a survey with students. It's easier to administer in a high school or a middle school level. When you get down to kindergarten, first and second grade, although there's ways of doing it, it becomes a little more difficult. But it is required under statute that we find ways to measure student engagement. And then the teacher improvement process is the other, how do we work with improving teachers that are not meeting the standards? There are three basic components if you look at the law. It's the 35% achievement, the student engagement, and then the other part is really what we've observation of teacher practice. Those are the three big components. The law requires that this be done on a three-year professional review cycle. And tied to a growth plan for teachers, the summative evaluation must be performed by a qualified and trained evaluator. And in the that summative evaluator is a school administrator, because that's what goes into the teacher's records and things that happen as a result. There is a peer review process, feedback, coaching process that is to take place every year within this three-year review process, and we can explain more detail if you wish, but that's kind of the concepts. The joint agreement I mentioned earlier, that process should have been completed by now for all school districts, or they're required to use the state model. We have asked for letters of assurance that these teacher evaluation programs are in place and they should be being implemented as we begin this year. A charter director has to sign that. For fiscal year 2015 only, I think the Senate had in their bill last year about a $9 to $10 million appropriation. That came out to $302 per teacher. Remember, QCOMP is $260 per student. This is $302, a one-time appropriation per teacher. Again, staffing at the department, we have two staff people. We've had some state dollars that is not ongoing funding to assist with the program. It's again ends. That appropriation came in 2013, was for the biennium, and it was also used for what we help implement or get districts up and running, and also to do an evaluation of the components that are in our mandated model. Similarities. The purpose of the strength are basically the same, to develop and evaluate teachers and primarily focus to student outcomes. Local control, where you have to have the joint agreement. The emphasis on instruction and feedback. There's roles for peer reviewers, coaches, observations, leadership positions for teachers. We want staff development aligned to what we gain out of the outcomes, job-embedded learning, that type of stuff, and the MDA to provide professional assistance. Differences. QCOMP or ATPPS has compensation or performance awards built in. That's not in the teacher evaluation process. We have performance appraisals and potential for teacher improvement. There is in the plan something that lays out the growth factors or discipline if necessary, and that's in the statute. QCOMP or ATPPS, the commissioner has to review and approve plans. The other one, we have letters of assurance. The roles are a little bit different. Teacher observers must have an evaluative role. There was a lot of attention paid to inter-rater reliability when they started out in QCOMP. because non-administrative folks were also giving the feedback and doing the evaluative. The teacher observers may have an evaluative role in the teacher evaluation, but the school leaders or the summative evaluators must be trained and are usually school administrators because it could be tied to a job performance review. Funding is different. ATPS is voluntary. A funding cap up to $260 a student. TDE was a one-time funding source last session, $302 per teacher. And the MDE role is also different. Alignment issues that were considered by the group, is not a letter of intent. The application process is different. The local plans are both through joint agreement. Teacher roles are similar but not necessarily identical. Compensation is different within the two plans. The three-year professional review cycle is laid out in TDE. There may be more of an ongoing part of this review cycle in the pre-comp process, but that's a local decision. I laid out the funding. The actual cost of implementation is still kind of an unknown, but as we've looked at when we are doing the evaluation or the study group, we looked at UFAR's reporting from districts trying to figure out what all QCOMP dollars were being spent on, what were the costs involved in implementing such a program. It was difficult to always ascertain how much was in compensation because one of the requirements under QCOMP was that they maybe restructure their salary schedule. And so if they're restructuring their salary schedule to have fewer steps and lanes and more categories, they would have to use some of the dollars to put into that restructuring, which would show up as salary but not necessarily be able to be pulled out because it would be an ongoing restructuring of their schedule. We heard about stipends that were given, one-time stipends or one-time recognitions as part of QCOMP. Again, that's not part of the teacher development process, at least not required by statute, but it may be going on because of local decisions. Again, I'd like to reiterate there's three or four things that kind of stuck out. One was the availability of resources for some districts, but not all. That it was more that many smaller districts felt that they were at a disadvantage in order to put a program like this in place because of QCOMP, because they had fewer staff people to do the peer reviewing and all the parts that would go with it. All teachers like, this is where we saw the rise of professional learning communities and the ability of teachers to look at data and information about their students and to confer and meet. Professional development changed. I think it changed for the best, but we do need to find ways of using that throughout the state with all of our schools. With that, I'm going to have our staff come up and insert the recommendations from the committee. Misty and Kelly will be happy to talk about the recommendation. Steve? I'm going to take ours out. I'm going to put theirs in. You have a one-page, you have in front of you the actual report. They have synopsized the actual recommendations. It says TDE ATPPS work group. There's an introduction, but the actual recommendations begin on the second page. They have process recommendations, and they will have funding recommendations. The process recommendations deal with how what they would see as an end product. Yep, and then the funding recommendations will be tied to that. Misty will cover an introduction for you. You also have a one-pager that's a graph that looks like this that kind of puts it all in one page as we go through it as well. I'm going to turn
it over. I believe that's in black and white.
Right, but above the line would be, below the line would be the required elements of a combined system, and above the line would be optional components of what they're laying out. So
thank you. And Ms. Hermanson, excellent presentation. we have to be out by 10:30, and I'm hoping that maybe the next part could go about 10 to 15 minutes or so by the co-chairs, and then we could receive testimony from two persons that have been waiting for about 5 minutes each, and then recognizing we will have proposals on this, one introduced today and other ones coming, where we'll hear this in further detail in early March.
Thank you. We'll try to be briefer.
It's well done. And welcome, co-chairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Misty Sato. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in teacher development. And as co-chair of the work group, we just want to reiterate the purpose of this diverse group of people came together to seek alignment between these two different areas of statute. Diverse meaning we had parent representatives, business representatives, similar to what you heard from the assessment committee, tapping into as many different stakeholder groups around the state as possible. As you look at the report that Rose pointed you to, we wanted to just preface this with three premises about your reading and taking up the recommendations in the report. The first overall premise is that the fundamental expectations of both laws are preserved while we encourage the merger of these two different programs in statute. You'll see some differences in how we set up the recommendations for funding, but we want to preserve the current teacher development and evaluation requirements and preserve the professional development and roles for teacher leadership in the QCOMP statutes. The second premise is that as you look at these 11 recommendations, they are not meant to be select and choose. They are a package. We think that this represents an overall comprehensive and coherent approach to teacher development and how to link that teacher development to effective teacher evaluation. So all of these components, including training the evaluators and looking at the evaluation process, need to be held together in a total package. And the third premise is that we don't think that any of this will be viable or realistic in districts without funding. We currently have the QCOMP funding in place, and we will make a funding recommendation to keep funding and expand funding in order to make this a reality in school districts. So Kelly will be talking about the 11 process recommendations and the three funding recommendations, and you can follow along in your report as you don't have a copy of these slides. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you. I'm Kelly Spies. I'm the QCOMP coordinator for Bloomington Public Schools. I've also been a teacher in Minnesota for the past 30 years. So
thank you.
I am going to go through the recommendations and give you a little background about what happened as a part of just a very dynamic process in coming to consensus on those recommendations. Recommendation one is programs should continue to be developed locally. We found on the committee that we had many districts complying with the law that weren't a part of QCOMP, and they had put together some very robust teacher evaluation plans, and they wanted to maintain them as is. Also, we had many QCOMP districts represented as well, and they've had their plans in place for years, and they wanted to continue to have that locally developed and a jointly developed plan. Recommendation two is it should be include the development and evaluation as teachers as a means of improving those student outcomes. Continued development allows teachers to create a mindset of continuous progress. A comprehensive program allows opportunities for both the teachers and the students to be on a journey of continual improvement. Recommendation three, this three-year cycle allows for, again, that continuous improvement by using formative feedback and that continued reflection on teaching practice. Recommendation four, collecting and analyzing the several types of data allows for a more accurate picture of teacher effectiveness and student progress over time. Recommendation five, practicing teachers know their craft best. The opportunity for these teachers to coach and mentor and work together analyzing student achievement data should be a part of every teacher's day. Recommendation six, this sharing of best practices should come from the wisdom of peers who share a common knowledge of students and the curriculum standards within those districts. Recommendation seven, the integrity of the observation data as well as the trusting relationships between colleagues will be at risk without keeping that data private. Teachers are taking risks and improving instruction when they know that this is a safe experience. Recommendation eight, stipends and extra assignment pay is a function of the resources within a district. We heard loud and clear from districts with stipends and extra assignments and without, and it should be locally determined based on those resources within a district. Recommendation nine, although all staff deserves an appropriate evaluation process, these recommendations are designed specifically for licensed educators throughout the state of Minnesota. And recommendation 10, MDE has provided amazing resources. I'm just coming off a site review in Bloomington from QComp using questions, standards, and rubrics put together by MDE. And they should be allowed to continue to provide that kind of support to districts to keep us on track for best practices. They will continue to provide this assistance with the recommendations we've brought forward. We also have recommendation 11 for the evaluation of probationary teachers. The evaluation of probationary teachers should be aligned with how we evaluate tenured teachers. The way teachers are working together and collaborating, we can't have two separate systems. These need to be aligned more closely for having the same indicators of success for all teachers, no matter how many years they've been in the system.
And, Mr. Chair, this was something we kind of took liberties with because it was not necessarily in our charge. When we looked at the law as it relates to probationary teachers, we kind of felt it wasn't workable because if you read the statute and take it literally, it says that all probationary teachers have to be evaluated, have to have an evaluation consistent with Subdivision 8 or Subdivision 5, and that's all those components I talked about, the 35% achievement, student engagement, and observations. It says the evaluation, well, the first one has to be done within 90 days. We are not going to have that information on a teacher who's been employed for the first 90 days. We suspect that what was met was that they must be observed and provided feedback within the first 90 days. So we think that we have to somehow go into that statute and clean it up a little bit so that districts, if you read it literally, have to do the full component of the teacher evaluation through Subdivision 8, and it probably is not workable. So it's just an aside, but we do need to look at that specifically.
Thank you. Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did the input or the testimony that the work group received address the differences between school districts that of size, you know, fairly large school districts and relatively small school districts, which would be, you know, in rural communities?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had a superintendent from one of the smallest school districts in the state on our working group, and we also had Kelly, who's with one of the larger school districts in the state. We had charter schools. There was a robust discussion about the issues around all different sizes and structures that were brought to the table. That superintendent was quite vocal about, he was not a QComp district, and he was quite vocal about how he could have used the resources in order to help him put in place some more, work with the teacher evaluation process. But yes, we did get feedback from them as part of the discussion.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, on recommendation eight, when you
talk about provisions for alternative compensation or performance pay should be locally determined and will not be requirement of all districts. This doesn't really address the cost of that districts will have to put in to comply with the law, could you just expand on that? What are you getting at? I can see the pay, but there's a disparity right now between districts.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, if I could look at the three funding recommendations, I think we can bring a little clarity to your question. Okay. The first funding recommendation is that all districts should have available to them what is currently available under the ATPPS law, which is the $169 per student in state aid and the opportunity to levy. And then if you look at the diagram that is provided in that black and white version here, what we're recommending is that the funding be used specifically for activities that are identified in the teacher development and evaluation law, which are specified on this slide and in the lower portion of that diagram that you have. So the state aid would be targeted toward the summative evaluation, the student academic growth measures, the professional roles for teachers, the student engagement measures, individual growth, and classroom observations. Whereas in funding recommendation 3, you would have the option of levying to add to your state aid for elements in the program design that would be locally designed, which would include performance pay and alternative compensation for teachers. So we're trying to make some of these a requirement that is under the teacher development and evaluation, and recommend that things such as performance pay be an option for districts to pursue if they choose to, and that they would use levy dollars to pay for performance pay for teachers.
Okay.
Senator Stone.
And then finally, Mr. Chairman, does the role that the department have, is the department have the capabilities of ramping up for all districts?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, we've had one-time dollars. We probably need some type of ongoing support if we're going to maintain the staff to work with all districts. And we can, give you more specifics on that. But right now we have two or three people that are working with both QComp and teacher development. They are very busy. They have done a lot of work outstate. They've traveled all around the state. They're doing webinars, but there's a lot of need for assistance out there, and in particular in the areas in which we do not have assessments, and in help in developing the student engagement process, coaching for training the evaluators, the summative evaluators. Eventually, we probably need to build that into our training for principals and other administrators. But right now, I know when I was doing the principal evaluation work group, and they saw this as they really felt they needed more assistance in pulling together the materials to do a good summative evaluation and providing the necessary feedback for the development of their teachers. So there are definitely needs. In the areas where we do not have assessments, districts have to find out a way to come up with the 35%. We are using the process called student learning goals, but districts are asking for a lot of help in how they help teachers establish those student learning goals, measure them with reliability and validity, and use them appropriately.
Okay.
Sir Stump?
Just a final kind of a follow-up. Over the years, what I saw, the difficulty I saw with small school districts is the inability to have any sizable resource to do anything. So if you take a school district like, 200, and I have several of those that are relatively small, the $169, and staff can correct my math if it isn't correct, but it actually amounts to about $33,800. So for a school district that has, certain set number of teachers, and they have these responsibilities, and they have $33,800 to work with, it doesn't go very far. And that is the crux of I think, the problem in greater Minnesota. We looked at the potential over the years of maybe having like a service co-op, trying to make that service more than one small school district rather than each individual small school district having to do their own. The problem there is you run into contracts, individual school contracts. So I think the difficulty, and that's exactly why they didn't get into the QCOM, because they found the paper and all of the processing and everything, plus the subjectivity at the time, it was impossible. So I think the department will have to have resources to help some of these, work through some of these issues, because small school districts don't have the resources for subs, they don't have the resources for mentors, they don't have the resources for doing all the clerical stuff that probably needs to be done. I don't have a solution as such, but I think the assumption is that that districts will gladly appreciate the $169, they'll levy to the very max to get the other portion of it, and I think that'll happen across the state.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I think your assumptions are probably pretty accurate. We do have some districts on QCOMP who haven't levied to the max, but very few. There is going to be a need for some type of, for example, a small district with maybe one science teacher. How do you give the appropriate feedback? We're going to have to utilize other entities to assist, maybe the service co-ops or regional centers, or an agreement among districts on how to give feedback to a teacher who may be unique in their presentation. On the other hand, big districts have similar, because they have such a wide variety of staff in place. So, putting this into practice in an effective way is going to take some creative thinking and some new designs that we have not used in the past.
Thank you. Ms. Hermanson, Ms. Spies, and Ms. Sato, thank you very much for an excellent report presentation. We'll be delving further into it in subsequent hearings.
And thank you for being here. I would like to thank the chair. He did come to a couple of our meetings, and I know your staff were at almost all of them, so we appreciate their attention to it.
Thank you. We have two testifiers on the agenda. I'd like both of them to approach. Holly Craigthorpe from Educators for Excellence and Jody Buehr from Ed Minnesota, and perhaps each of you could go for about 5 minutes, and recognizing we'll have ample opportunity to pursue this at subsequent hearings. But we appreciate getting your overall insights right now. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Holly Craigthorpe, and I'm a Minneapolis Public Schools teacher, currently on a leave of absence. I'm a 14-year veteran teacher, and prior to taking my leave, I was the union steward at my school. I'm also a parent of two elementary school-aged children, and currently I serve as an advocacy fellow for Educators for Excellence, which is a teacher-led organization that works locally to elevate the teaching profession, bring teacher voices like mine to the policy table, and increase student achievement. Two of our teacher policy groups at E4E during the last year and a half have researched case studies in two areas, quality compensation and teacher diversity. And I believe that Ms. Livingston gave you some handouts that I brought to her, and I also have a full report here that I can get to that I wasn't able to get to her quite yet. We got together to research what's been happening around the nation in other areas like Colorado and Florida and California and Kentucky in the areas of QCOMP. And after school, we would get together, review the research, and come up with recommendations, which is what I will bring to you today. I'm just going to highlight a couple of our priorities around these recommendations, not all of our recommendations. Like the MDE advisory group, we also support the idea of funding teacher evaluations because our policy team found teacher evaluation to be the cornerstone of a solid QComp program and just critical to all teachers. We also believe QComp encompasses much more than just teacher evaluation, and therefore it deserves to be funded at a greater amount than teacher evaluation alone. As you know, QComp is a holistic approach that includes those five areas of teacher evaluation, job-embedded professional development, career ladders, performance pay, and alternate salary schedules. Research conducted by the U of M shows that students in schools where QComp is implemented gained on average an increase of achievement equal to that of one additional month of instruction. And the U of M analysis found the financial return on QComp investment to be $5 for every dollar spent. The research show even bigger gains from students who had teachers who were early career teachers. And we know that here in Minnesota, many early career teachers are in low-income schools or teaching students of color. My own union voted to adopt QComp in 2005 and then again in 2013. QComp has offered our teachers mainly one thing that we can never get enough of, and that is time. We've had time to examine common assessment data, time to participate in job-embedded professional development, like observing our colleagues, time for collaboration with education assistants, and time to take on site-based leadership positions. All this adds up to more focused and personalized instruction for our students. In order to maximize the impact that QComp can have on the highest need school, we are also arguing that districts should have the flexibility to use QComp dollars to incentivize effective and highly effective teachers to work in hard-to-staff schools or hard-to-staff positions. QComp funds could be used toward hiring bonuses, additional prep time, or other incentives in those hard-to-staff schools. This is not a request for additional funding. It is a request for flexibility that the state specify that QComp funds could be used for this purpose. We are working to introduce this new statute for hard-to-staff schools, and we ask for your support when the bill reaches this committee. We welcome your feedback and questions, and we hope that we will be able to work with you during this session on solutions to narrow Minnesota's achievement gap. Thank you for hearing our recommendations and open questions.
Thank you, Ms. Craigthorpe. And we'll hear next from Ms. Buer, and if there's time for questions, we will.
All right. Welcome. Thank you, Chair Wieger and committee members. For the record, Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. Just in the essence of time, my colleague Jody Olson is with me, but I'm going to speak on both the testing and the TDE, and I will be brief. We first just want to say that we very much support and are thankful for the work of both the task forces on the testing. We totally support their overall goal to require fewer and better tests. And we have had conversations with some of you and look forward to further conversations about very specific proposals that we are going to be hoping to put forward and talk to you more about around the lines of reducing the testing burden on our students and the high stakes factor of those tests. One of them is that we are supporting the legislation that's moving forward in Congress around the grade span testing that was mentioned briefly by MDE, and we support that. This approach would greatly reduce the amount of testing, and it actually, if you're not familiar with it, it proposes to test students in each subject, once in elementary, once in middle school, and once in high school, which results in what we're looking for, and not only just the reduction in the volume, but to allow our teachers more time to teach and spend one-on-one time with students, and for students to have more time for learning, which is our ultimate goal. The other proposal that we have talked to some of you about and we're hoping to put forward and look forward to further conversations, Mr. Chair, committee members, around that, is for our EL students. We are looking to allow more instructional time for those students before they are required to take the MCA. And so I will talk to you more about that in a future hearing, hopefully. The last one I would just like to mention is the proposal that Commissioner Casilius mentioned in her letter to Education Committee members, and that MDE mentioned earlier to you today, and that is on the potential of limiting the instructional time for testing to 2%. I just want to say we are currently discussing this and reviewing it, but it's certainly something that I think we are interested in having further conversations and vetting to determine if it's something that we should be looking at pursuing. So that's one we'll be talking about more. If we want Minnesotan students to compete with workers around the world, we really have to begin to address this issue. We test our students more than any other country, and we shouldn't be doing that. And I just want to lastly say on the testing that we look forward to future conversations with you about that on proposals that we'll be putting forward. On the TDE task force, we again just want to say we very much support the work of that group. And two key things that we would just say, they've been mentioned, but they're worth repeating. Adequate funding of those recommendations is essential for it to be successful. And I think we all agree on that. Also, continued flexibility and local control of developing those plans, which I think you've heard from others. We totally support that. So I thank you for your time. You've listened to a lot this morning, and we look forward to working with you more on both these issues in the future.
Thank each of you. And Senator Kippenmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Craigthorpe, I was impressed by the fact that out of all the conversations here, you're the only one that mentioned teacher prep accountability. I thought that was interesting because we're talking about our students, preparing them for their careers, and we recognize the value of all of that. Well, it's also equally important to think about the teacher, colleges, university, teaching schools, teacher preparation programs, and her comment here is held accountable for effectively training their student teachers. And I thought that was very interesting because it philosophically aligns with what we're trying to do for our students. We should do the same thing. And so starting at the beginning, you might say, is that prior to a first-year teacher, and they have some recommendations here. And so, Ms. Craigthorpe, I hope maybe you might develop this a little bit more and maybe expand on this because other people have taken some of these other areas. But so far, you're the only one on this one, and I think that really could use a little more attention.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for your question. So we've had two policy groups, like I mentioned, one on QComp and one on teacher diversity, and the teacher prep accountability recommendations came out of our teacher diversity working group, and I can bring you a similar report that further fleshes those out. But as teachers and members of E4E, we want to see support from induction all the way through to teacher leaders and master teachers. And our recommendations are around developing accountability for teacher prep programs, very similar to House File 244 and Senate File 264, I believe. And the only thing that we would add, or not the only thing I should say, but an important thing that we would love to see as part of those recommendations for teacher prep programs is that data is broken out by race so that we can see how teacher prep programs are serving future teachers of color. So what percentage of teachers of color are graduating from their programs, are actually obtaining a license, are actually getting a job then, and then what is how are their students performing? Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Any further questions, comments from the committee? Not well. Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you to everyone and for viewers that would like to share opinions on these two very important subjects on testing and teacher development evaluation. Please share that with us. These will be very key items as we put together our policy and finance bills over the next several weeks. Our calendar for the next 2 weeks is listed at the bottom of the agenda. It's fairly full. You'll note that includes the governor's budget proposal for education and other items, and we have requests in for other bills. We're working on the March schedule right now, and if there's anything you'd like to talk to me about personally for any additional requests, you know, Senator Weber, for example, Senator Names are working on a provision in their area. But right now, and looking at Senator Kent, I know you have items, and perhaps everyone does, but we need to process these because I truly do want to hear all the proposals, but it won't be long before we're looking at that first deadline. So any additional comments, questions? There being none, our committee will adjourn.